Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on September 3rd, 2019. This is class 4 of 32 of our structured study of Vipassana, Introspective Insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the second of two talks during this study on the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta, the primary sutta on dependent origination. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight is our fourth class, actually 4-2. It's the second talk in this series on dependent origination. I gave this talk on Saturday. And the video didn't take, so I want to have a video of this. But also, this really is the probably the most important sutta, because it especially in our study, but it explains the entire purpose of what an awakened human being taught and why he taught what he taught and why he didn't teach other things. This dependent origination, the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta, and there's other teachings where the Buddha teaches this dependent origination, not just this, and he's consistent in each and every one. One of the most remarkable things that I found about the Buddha's teaching, no matter where you look in the Pali Canon, in the Sutta Pitaka, there is a consistency. This man never wavered at all from his message. And this is singularly important. Much of, and this corruption to dependent origination began even during the Buddha's life, and it solidified with the Mahasanghikas between the first and second Buddhist council, and between the second and third Buddhist council. The Theravadins jumped in and created their own version of a very magical, mystical version of this. And they all adapted, accommodated, and embellished this sutta to allow for a non-dual thinking, which is something that was rooted in Hinduism that the Buddha rejected, and this whole idea of universal consciousness, one mind, unity consciousness, and they may be true, but they are irrelevant and a distraction to what the Buddha taught. Another words that are often used to describe dependent origination or dependent co-arising is interdependent origination or interdependent co-arising or interconnectedness of all beings. A very famous teacher today uses the word interbeing to describe what he'd like dependent origination to mean. And if you go look online at any of these teachers, you'll see that what they're teaching has nothing to do with what the Buddha actually taught. And that's unfortunate, because everything the Buddha taught is informed by this one teaching. And this one teaching speaks directly to the vipassana, the introspective insight that the Buddha teaches we must have if we're going to awaken. And that introspective insight is into the not self characteristic, meaning wrong views of self, views ignorant of Four Noble Truths, clinging those views to all impermanent phenomena that results in dukkha, stress and suffering. Those are the three marks of existence. Is that a little bit clear to everyone? Because that's really the foundation, but the whole purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma is to understand ultimately that because I don't understand who I am in relation to the world around me, it simply follows that stress and suffering will be there, correct? I mean, think about any situation. If you don't understand what you're doing there, you're going to be stressful, aren't you? Well, we are living our whole lives not knowing what the hell we're doing here. Why? Because nobody taught us Four Noble Truths. It took Siddhartha Gautama, of course this is 2,600 years ago, this incredibly brilliant man, to figure this out. And when he set out in his search for understanding, he had this one single goal. Where does stress and suffering arise from? And what can I do about it? And wouldn't you know, he figured it out. And this describes it. The Buddha was at Savatthi, at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed those assembled. Friends, I will describe in detail dependent origination. Listen carefully. And what is dependent origination? So the Buddha starts out immediately describing to us what our problem is. From ignorance as a requisite condition, ignorance of Four Noble Truths as a requisite condition, comes fabrications. A fabrication is a view that I've made about myself in relation to the world, but it's rooted in ignorance. That's why it's a fabrication. It's not based in any type of reality. But once I've made that, because I made it, because I created this fabrication, and it could be anything, but typically it has to do with the personalization of a human life, I'm now bound to those views, as a Buddha talks. That's clinging to a view, whatever that view might be. And as we go through our lives, things occur to us, we react to them, and we try to start fitting our experience into a fabricated view, a view rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. To simply state, I try to fit my views of myself in relation to the world into an ignorant view. What's going to follow from that? What can only follow from that? Another ignorant view, a fabricated view, a lack of understanding who I am in relation to the world, resulting in stress and suffering. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. From those fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. Look at the verbiage used here. Of course, this is a translation from the Pali, but this is what the Buddha said 2,600 years ago. Fabrications require ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And once that is established, now my consciousness, the consciousness that I have, you've got to qualify this too. This is not some consciousness with a capital C, a grand cosmic consciousness that we're all a part of. It simply means in the context of dependent origination, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. From ignorance to fabrications, those fabrications are now feeding and informing my consciousness, the way that I'm thinking about myself in relation to the world. From that consciousness, from that corrupted consciousness, as a requisite condition, comes name and form. Name and form, the Pali word is namarupa, and there's all kinds of elaborate explanations. It simply means name and form. It means I've given a name. I've self-identified with this form. I'm taking things personal. From ignorance to fabricated views, to those fabricated views feeding the way that I'm thinking about myself. And now, from that fabricated way of looking at the world, I'm now identifying myself in that world. Is that clear with everyone?
Mm-hmm.
From name and form as a requisite condition. Again, notice the progression. All of this is required for us to end up where this takes us. As a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. So this isn't a creation myth. It's not I've gone this far in dependent origination and all of a sudden my six senses are born into the world. It has nothing to do with physical birth. Nothing, this sutta. Even though most people claim this is a creation myth. Obviously, there's nothing about that. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. The sixth sense base is our five physical senses and the sixth sense of consciousness or ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. So again, look at the progression. I've now identified myself. I've given this form a name. It's me. I'm taking things personal in my world now. And by the way, we'll understand through this course of study, there's nothing personal in the world. That's a key to the Buddha's teaching. But now, because of ignorance, I am taking things personal. And as things are interpreted, we're human beings. We interpret the world. We come in contact with the world with our senses. It took an awakened human being to recognize the problem in that, though. If I'm interpreting the world through this sixth sense base, through a mind that is rooted in ignorance of what's occurring, I can only further my own ignorance. And so my interpretive senses are now interpreting the world from that ignorant view. But there's an option here. There's an alternative. There's a way out. There's an eightfold path to go from wrong views of self, anatta, to right views of self, an awakened view. From the sixth sense base, as a requisite condition, comes contact. Makes sense, doesn't it? And so this process happens not in linear time, or we could say that it happens so quick that we don't really notice it, and that's not important. We can understand through the Buddha's teaching the progression that now leads us from a mind rooted in ignorance coming in contact with a world that I'm ignorant about. And again, this is not a statement to say as human beings we're simply ignorant and we're lost. It has nothing to do with that. It's a very specific ignorance, ignorance of Four Noble Truths. But as far as the Buddha is concerned, that's the whole enchilada. How is the Mexican restaurant tonight? By the way? That's the whole enchilada. Understanding the relationship between a self and the world around it. From that contact, as a requisite condition, comes feeling. Makes sense. But so now, because I'm interpreting what's occurring to me through a mind rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, and a feeling is generated, that feeling is taken personally. How often do we describe, how often do we describe ourselves to others by how we feel? In fact, that's the common question. How are you doing today? How do you feel? And it's just an encouragement to take things personal. Feelings are just as fleeting as everything else in the world. They're completely impermanent. And the Buddha develops, the Buddha's Dhamma develops a way of feeling things in the most meaningful and profound way. Now think about this. In the most meaningful and profound way, without taking any of it personally. Can you imagine that? I can live in the world stress-free as long as I can understand that there's nothing personal. That's what this is teaching us. Look at the progression. If I'm taking something personal, it's because I'm lacking understanding of the way things are. It's the heart of the matter. From that feeling, and we use feelings all the time, don't we, to validate our fabrications and validate our place in the world. And things that make us feel good, we want more of them. People that make us feel good, we want more of that relationship. People that take away from our peace and our security and our happiness, we don't want anything to do with them. Situations that threaten our peace and our happiness, we don't want anything to do with that. The problem is both of those scenarios, enjoying certain things and having aversion to certain things, when we personalize them, become stressors. We want more of the things that make us happy and make us safe, and we don't want anything to do with anything else that would take away from that. And we get caught in this constant way of grasping after. And aversion is another sign, another aspect of grasping or craving. Two sides of the same coin. And so we live our lives grasping after what we think we need to be happy and holding on to those things as if our life depends on it. And underlying that is this tension of avoiding anything that might take away from that. And so our minds are constantly thrown into the past and into the future, and we're never right here. The Buddha taught a Dhamma for each and every human being who was interested to learn how to finally unite their mind and their body and keep it there. Because the only way we can practice the Dhamma is the only way we can live our life, right here, right now. To have the mindful presence, to have a well-concentrated mind, to be fully mindful of life as life occurs, without taking anything personally. Does everybody know, see that as a reasonable goal?
Yes.
It is. Most people, I mean, most people say, nah, that doesn't sound good. But we understand that. It's the, in fact, it's the most reasonable goal as human beings we could want, to live our lives. Because if we're not, if our minds are still stuck in ignorance, we might have the most successful lives. It's the outer appearance is no bellwether for how much ignorance we have. Look around. Very, very successful people are, some of them, it's obvious that they're still rooted in ignorance, but we all are. It's a common human condition. The three marks of existence are the common human condition. And those of us that want to do something about it, we are so fortunate that we found a direct eightfold path to develop understanding where there once was once ignorance. From that feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. Kind of just explained that. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. So once I decide what I need, my desires are now in full bloom, and desire again, remember it's craving and aversion are the two things, or the same thing. They're all rooted in ignorance. And so, once I've established in my mind things that I want and things that I identify with, because I've taken them personally, I'm now clinging to them. This is how ignorance is continued, by clinging and maintaining. And so we create very elaborate fabrications about who I am in relation to the world, what I need, what I'm about, what other people are about, what the world is about, and the list is endless. And we start creating ideologies. And usually those ideologies are encouraged by who we're associating with, within and without something like a Dhamma practice. That's why it's so important. If you're going to develop the Dhamma, you associate with the Dhamma. In a much broader way, when we're clinging ourselves to any view that is represented by an object, event, a view, or an idea that is a fabrication, we're not here. We're not living our lives. We're living that fabrication. And we're insisting that the fabrication is real. Is everybody following me? And so there's great stress in that, isn't it? I use different examples, but one would be that I want to learn how to change the oil in a car. But I realize that there's a brilliant professor of comparative religions. So I go to him because he's really smart and he's got a lot of following. And I take his classes for a few times and I realize, wait a minute, I came here to learn how to change the oil. What's going on here? How come this guy is failing me? He ripped me off. The problem is I got a fabricated view of how to learn something. And unless I actually go and study the mechanics of changing an oil, changing the oil in a car, I can't learn it, can I? I can study. I can go to school for the rest of my life. But if I don't study the right subject, I can't learn it. If I don't study a subject that is designed to show me my fabrications and my views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, I can't expect to develop it. I can engage in spiritual practices or modern Buddhist practices forever and ever and ever, and that's often how they're presented. And I'll never get anywhere. And those of you that know my story, that's how it was for me until I came across this. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. Becoming what? Becoming further ignorant. Look at the progression here. This, the way this is written, further becoming, is hardly ever has a qualifier or a modifier after it. Meaning, what does it mean? What becoming what? So you have to understand the context. Where do we start? From ignorance. From ignorance as a requisite condition through this originating process. I can only hope to become further ignorant unless something interrupts the process. And that's the Eightfold Path. And this points to the importance of the present moment. Because as we develop the Dhamma, we're going to understand that each moment of our lives holds the potential to become further ignorant or to incline our minds through the Eightfold Path to become awakened. And that's really the only choice we have at each and every moment. And it's helpful for a Dhamma practitioner to recognize that. If we're feeling stressed out, if we're taking something personal in this moment, we can recognize, wait a minute, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. Take another breath and step back into reality. Because no matter what it is that's causing stress and suffering or distraction or confusion or frustration or disenchantment or unsatisfactoriness in this moment, it's because I'm taking it personal. And if I can just remind myself, if I can gather my thoughts into that well-concentrated mind and see things clearly, I'll realize there's nothing personal here. And it changes everything. Is that an accurate statement, folks? Mm-hmm. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. And again, it gets right to the heart of the matter of those three marks of existence. That central part of that, the anatta, the misunderstanding of self. Everything revolves around that, and everything resolves in that. From becoming, as a requisite condition, comes birth. And this is such an important line. This is another great misunderstanding is that Buddha taught rebirth as a physical birth, and that he taught that we are subject to endless birth, death, and rebirth cycles. He didn't say that that's not true. He simply said that's not the key teaching, and it's irrelevant as far as the Dhamma is concerned. The Buddha was not concerned about any future life. He didn't care about it. His big concern was teaching human beings how to awaken in this life right now, right here. And there's many stories throughout the Sutta Pitaka of people hearing his teachings for the first time or very early. Sariputta Moggallana come to mind. What's his name from the Dhammacakkhandana? There's not a lot to do here, and we can awaken rather quickly. For most of us, it's going to take 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, maybe a little bit longer. But the point is, this is an immediate Dhamma. It's not something that we build up merit and we do a lot of good things or chant a lot or bow a lot and then in some future life we'll be rewarded. The Buddha had taught nothing like that. What is important is in this progression is what am I giving birth to in this moment? And it relates just to that step before this becoming. What am I? What am I giving birth to in this moment? Because I can give birth in my mind, in the way that I'm thinking. I'm not, again, this has nothing to do with physical birth. I can give birth to any experience I want, as long as I have control of my thinking.
John,
is
becoming and birth a bit redundant? Or is it just a continuation?
The birth, yeah, it is. But the birth would be now the manifest. And notice where we go in the next step. Birth is more the physical and mental manifestation of ignorance.
That's the aggregates?
Yes. Yeah, well, maybe I'll talk a little more about that too. So the important thing about this is, what am I giving birth to in this moment? In the Vitakkasiddhanta Sutta, the Buddha teaches that we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it. We regain control of our minds. That, again, that's really the whole point. And it all resolves in this thing called the not-self-characteristic, in anatta. If I have developed that profound concentration that's developed through jhana meditation, and I've developed that refined mindfulness to hold in mind, mindfulness means to hold in mind, the Eightfold Path, then in this moment, I am going to give birth to another moment rooted in wisdom. And you've heard me say this often. When you really understand what the Eightfold Path does for me and all of us as disciples of the Dhamma, it brings us great power to live calmly and peacefully in the moment. Because I know when I'm seeing the world and interacting in the world from that overarching right view, there's nothing else I can do to add or take away from this moment. I'm fully alive. I'm fully present. I can do, this is going to sound to some of you new people, I can do no wrong when I have integrated the Eightfold Path. And there is such incredible freedom in that. That's true peace of mind, because I no longer have to second guess myself, because I'm no longer trying to create and establish a fabricated self in the world. I'm simply, are you smiling? I can't tell.
You can climb in my head and see exactly what's going on. What goes on in my head.
Tell us, if I can. You don't have to. Would you mind telling?
It goes on to sort of like, we all tell sort of like white lies sometimes. You know, that's at the back of it. You know, we want to create ourselves.
Other people, you don't.
No. But, you know, it happens in... we exaggerate things or something like that, you know, just in conversation, and that's at the back of it. I mean, every time it's there.
Why do you think you do that, though?
Because to create myself.
Yeah.
To push my own ego, to whatever.
Yeah, and you could say that white lies are, you know, they don't hurt anybody, and most, you know, white lies, you know, the sky is green. Yes.
Yeah.
And again, it's not even in a, it mightn't be a, significant or meaningful, except who are you kidding? You're kidding yourself.
Yeah.
Again, the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma is to go from a fabricated way of living in the world to living in reality. And there's one way to do that. Let me keep going. From birth as a requisite condition, again, notice the progression, not physical birth, from giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. So it's not a lack of understanding that causes aging. What is the Buddha describing here? He's simply describing a common human life. Every human being is subject to these things. But we create individual stress and suffering by reacting to this, by not wanting to age, by being upset that we're sick. How many times, I think I said this Saturday, when you have a cold, you feel like you're going to have a cold forever. You feel like that's as good as you're ever going to feel until it passes. We forget that. And the deeper qualifiers that I'll get into are all parts of, are all common aspects of having a human life. Except when we take these things personally, birth, sickness, aging, and death, not getting what we want, receiving what we don't want and reacting to that. We are the ones creating stress in our lives. It's not the sickness, it's not the aging, it's not impending death, it's not getting what I want that's creating stress in my life, is it? It's by me resisting or reacting to what's a common occurrence in human life. It's simply foolish. Because in every life, these things are going to happen. But if we understand, truly understand the nature of human life, and we can let go of that section here of clinging and maintaining the fabricated views, there is no stress and suffering. We go through life gracefully, just the same as every other human being, but we don't lose our minds over it. Frank?
I would suppose that's why he set it up as the second part of the Eightfold Path of right intention. And I think that's such an important part of letting things go, is the renunciation. It's first understanding it, know what's happening, clinging and maintaining, giving birth to ignorance. I have to set a framework to let things go, you know.
Yeah.
When things feel like they're crushing you and you're taking them personal, renunciation is a goal. And letting go of ill will, not having any kind of anger over it.
Yeah. Thank you. The right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. And again, the short form is, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. Even as something as personal as sickness, aging, and death. It's not us. It's just what occurs as a common human experience. The Buddha doesn't leave us hanging right there. Now, what is aging and death? Aging is decrepitude, brokenness, graying, decline, the weakening of the faculties. Death is the passing away of the five clinging aggregates. The ending of time, and again, the qualifier, the ending of time as far as we're concerned. Because we, as far as the Dhamma is concerned, we got one chance to awaken. It's this lifetime. The ending of time, the interruption in the life faculties. The reference here to the five clinging aggregates. The five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, how that relates to dependent origination, and consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The five clinging aggregates are the Buddha's description, and a perfect description, of the ongoing personal experience of stress and suffering. Another word for the five clinging aggregates could be anatta. It also could be dukkha, one of the other marks, because that is the encapsulation. That's what we have formed ourselves. And if you look at those five aggregates, individually we cling them together and use them to describe a self. This physical form, the feelings that it has, the perceptions that I've developed rooted in ignorance, the mental fabrications that follow from those perceptions, and the ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths that's manifesting this whole heap of clinging aggregates. The ongoing personal experience of suffering. Now, what is birth? Birth is the descent. Now, relate this directly to a mind rooted in ignorance creating stress in itself, directly to the three marks of existence. Birth is the coming forth, the coming to be. Birth is the appearance of the sixth sense base, again, not in a physical way, the sixth sense base as a validator of ignorance. The sixth sense base in the five clinging aggregates. Now, what is becoming? Becoming is sensual becoming, form becoming, and formless becoming. That last formless becoming is often taught as a goal that we should strive for this, again, the realm of nothingness or emptiness, something the Buddha never taught. There's no humanity in nothingness or emptiness. The formless that the Buddha is talking about is creating speculative non-physical realities as a repository for this self once it's dead, passed on, maybe I should say, in this meaning, in this continuum, or has achieved a merit-based goal. In other words, if I do this long enough, one of the largest form of modern Buddhism is Pure Land Buddhism, which basically, I'm not going to do it complete justice, but basically it teaches that you keep this one particular chant on your in your mind and on your lips at all times, and if you're lucky enough to die with it on your lips, you'll be immediately taken to Amitabha Buddha heaven and be taken care of forever by Amitabha Buddha. It sounds wonderful. I actually came across that and practiced it wholeheartedly for about 2 weeks. It finally made no sense to me in relation to what the Buddha taught. It may be true, I'm not saying it's not, but that's the kind of formlessness that the Buddha's talking about, that a mind rooted in ignorance will grasp after. Any non-physical speculative self-establishment in any non-physical realm, whether it's a heaven or a hell realm, whether it's with the hungry ghost, etc., 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 is a formless realm that the Buddha said, don't go there. Everything the Buddha taught is to be experienced by a human being. And if it cannot be experienced by a human being didn't teach it. And formless becoming. And what is clinging and maintaining? There are four types of clinging. Clinging to sensory stimulus. Clinging to views or conditioned thinking. Clinging to precepts and practices. Again, the Buddha says this often, cautions against establishing precepts and practices as a prerequisite for your Dhamma practice, meaning a lot of rites and rituals and sacrifices that were common during the Buddha's time, and anything else that is used as a visualization technique or as an appeal or to appease gods or goddesses or other non-physical realm, non-physical beings such as devas. Buddha taught, don't do it. And clinging to a doctrine of self, continued eye-making. And what is craving? There are six classes of craving. Craving for more forms, more physical stuff. Craving for sounds. Craving for smells. Craving for tastes. Craving for physical sensations. And craving for ideas. All rooted in that sixth sense base. And once that sixth sense base is activated by ignorance and fabrications, there's no stopping it. It is a self-perpetuating type of ignorance. An aspect of ignorance is the word itself. We create very powerful and subtle strategies to ignore our own ignorance, particularly spiritual practices, but all types of things, whether you're spiritual or inclined or not. Some people get compulsive with golf. Some people get compulsive with shopping, with sex, with drugs and alcohol. Pick it. We do it, and it's all for that same reason, to distract ourselves from what's really occurring. And what is feeling? Feeling has six classes as well. Feeling arises from eye contact, from ear contact, from nose contact, from taste contact, from body contact, and from intellect contact. And we all know that. We smell something nice, we feel good. We smell something not so nice, we don't feel good. Or we hear something. You know, we hear a beautiful opera and it tends to relax us. We have a physical experience. We hear, I've got to be careful, you can't say anything. You hear some music that you don't like and you don't want to hear anymore. You have an aversion to it. Or sounds. Or even in meditation, you insist that everything must be absolutely quiet when you meditate. And so every little sound you kind of hear, and it takes you out of your meditation. That's what the Buddha's talking about. And we do that because we're taking all of this personally, when there's nothing personal at all. This is called feeling. And what is contact? Again, phenomena coming in contact with the six senses. I won't go through each and every one of them. This is called contact with the sixth sense base. And what is name and form? Feeling, perception, intention, attention, meaning all mental aspects, and contact. Discriminating self-referential consciousness is name, meaning I'm just giving names to things. I'm identifying or clinging myself to ordinary phenomena arising and passing away. I'm joining with it. The Buddha often talks about the problem with suffering is that we join with our suffering. We join with our suffering by joining with all types of phenomena, by creating an identity with it. Does everybody follow me with that identity, especially the new folks? Tim, Michael, Julia, are you following me? You got to learn a little something. I can't see very well, so you can't just shake your head. You got to say yes or no.
Yes.
Thank you. The reason why I'm asking you is because this really is the heart of the matter. That everything that Buddha taught resolves within ourselves. There's nothing outside of ourselves that we need to be looking for or hope to attain. It's all an inside job. Discriminating self-referential consciousness is named. The elements of water, fire, earth, and wind, that which makes up physical form, is called form. Name and form is discriminating consciousness. Discriminating in this sense, meaning I'm placing a value judgment on things. I like them, I don't like them, or I'm indifferent. Name and form is discriminating consciousness bound to or clinging to physical form. And what is consciousness? There are six classes of consciousness. Again, the Buddha refers to the five senses and that sixth sense of intellect, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And what are fabrications? There are three fabrications. There's bodily fabrications, there's verbal fabrications, and there's mental fabrications. So these fabrications that originally occur in our mind are then felt physically, and often verbally we're interacting with the world through our speech from a fabricated view. That's why right action, and right livelihood, the middle aspects of the Eightfold Path, are so important. And so many people that I teach over the years say that it's right speech that they start getting a feel for what this means, because it's obvious. We can, if we're mindful enough, we have a little bit of concentration, we can first start observing what's coming out of our mouth. And an important aspect of right speech is what we're telling ourselves, to look at that, because it's really that story that we have going on with ourselves, probably from the minute we're born, that we keep recreating and reinforcing ignorance. Look at it that way. And what is ignorance? Who was it? Eva asked, we had a good explanation of this. Ignorance, and again, this is when the Buddha states, and I state, that this is a Dhamma about recognizing ignorance. It's not that all, as a human being, we're simply ignorant. It's in this way. Ignorance is not knowing stress. Ignorance is not knowing the cessation of stress. Notice how this relates to the Four Noble Truths. Ignorance is not knowing the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of stress. This is called ignorance. That's specifically what we're looking to understand. Excuse me. The Buddha could nearly as accurately described the First Noble Truth as saying, excuse me, as saying there is dukkha, as saying there is distraction, there is preoccupation, because it is the preoccupation with dukkha that keeps us out of our body and keeps our mind stuck in the past and in the future, keeps our mind stuck in fabrications. And so the end of ignorance is understanding the origination of stress, ignorance of Four Noble Truths, the cessation of stress, which means you have the direct experience of knowing this. The Buddha often said, when you develop this, you know it. Everything the Buddha taught was taught to be experienced. We don't take anything on faith. Nothing. Because if it's taken on faith, it's no value to you, is it? You have to experience it. And the way we experience it is through this Eightfold Path. And not knowing the Eightfold Path. So now that we know the Eightfold Path, we can now say that we have found the end of ignorance, according to the Buddha. Now, from the remainderless fading and cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications. Look at what the Buddha's teaching us here. He first told us how we got in trouble through ignorance, and now he's telling us how to undo it. From the remainderless fading And cessation of ignorance comes the cessation of fabrication. So immediately, the whole 12-link chain of dependencies falls apart. And at any point that we unravel or cut one of these chains, the whole 12-link chain of dependencies simply vanishes. Continue. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. And this is just a progression of undoing what we've established in our own minds. From the cessation of name and form, meaning from the cessation of self-identifying with every thought, word, and idea that occurs, from the cessation of that comes cessation of the sixth sense base. So now, once I've let go of all views rooted in ignorance, now as I come in contact with the world, there's nothing to provoke a response rooted in ignorance. My mind is left calm and at peace, no matter what's occurring in the world. And think about that. Think about what's going on in the world today and the stressors that we have and the reactions that we have. And not have to go through that. That's what the Buddha taught us. We can live in the world without losing our minds because of the condition of the world, because the condition of the world is completely impersonal. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. From the cessation, meaning contact rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and maintaining. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming further ignorant. From the cessation of becoming further ignorant comes the cessation of birth, comes the cessation of giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of birth comes the cessation of sickness, aging, death, sorrow, pain, distress, despair, and confusion. Wisdom brings a cessation to the entire mass of stress and suffering. It's the end of the sutta. So, this, and those that have been coming often know that I say this rather regularly, but in the sutta is a complete Dhamma teaching. Of course, it's lacking the Eightfold Path, but we'll get to that. But it teaches us directly what the problem is, my individual ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It teaches me the consequence of that ignorance. Why? The Buddha could have said, especially if he was confined to 160 characters, if he could have said, ignorance is your problem. It causes stress. Go meditate. Or, you know, go jog 10 miles a day or come up with something, some type of path. But he didn't do that. This brilliant man said, from ignorance through 12 causative links that he described to us, that we can see in ourselves, we can see very clearly that we have done this to ourselves, not in a way to beat ourselves up, because it's so, one of the most empowering things that I came to after many, many years of frustration in modern Buddhism was the realization that it has nothing to do with finding the greatest Buddhist teacher or the greatest hybrid meditation method or the greatest belief or the greatest visualization, etc., etc., etc. It was only up to me. And that changed everything. And I hope it does for you. I think it has. I just want to see something there. And just to emphasize the point of how this relates to the three marks of existence. Ignorance occurs within a human life. It doesn't give birth to a human life. And it doesn't matter where we are in our life path, meaning we could be 15, we could be almost 64, we could be 102. It doesn't matter. If we have a human breath, we can practice the Dhamma. And if we're fortunate enough and we engage in right effort and right intention, we can awaken in this lifetime. We can resolve this core issue of wrong views of self, clinging to all impermanent phenomena, resulting in dukkha. So, let's go around. I'll start with Frank, because you guys got to leave.
How's everyone doing? Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Hello, Frank.
That was a great sutta. Just reading that with you gave me a lot of insight. And I'm going to have to go back and listen to it on the Podbean. I can't say that one thing's more important than the other, because it all, you know, understanding all of it, kind of, the experience of the four foundations of mindfulness and understanding the quality of my mind puts me in the right framework to know that I have to apply the Eightfold Path, because this not-self characteristic is not remembering, because it's not that I'm ignorant of the Four Noble Truths. Sometimes life happens so quick that I'm along that path, this clinging, these five clinging aggregates that I call self, travels along that chain of dependency, like sometimes like that.
Yeah.
I can understand why the Buddha left his family and went out into the forest, because personal relationships.
Nothing personal.
It's not you, Larry. It's okay.
The personal relationships that keep me clinging onto that thing that feels personal. You know, we have loved ones in our life,
yeah.
And you know, if you work for a living, you're interacting with coworkers and employees, and you know, it's also important. Right speech is really right on the mark when knowing when I'm in ignorance. So, thank you.
Thank you. Beautiful explanation of it. Eric, how are you tonight?
Good, how are you?
I'm good, thanks for asking.
So good to be here, good to see everyone. And yeah, I think that dependent origination is one of the ones that has taken me a longer to grasp, but the more that I understand of it, the more I see my own awareness grow in my own attachments, and just like along that line, there's so many different things that you can pick it up, at any part of on that chain.
Yep.
I don't know, and it's just each part relates. Yeah, it was
a
really good sutta tonight.
Thank you. Yeah, the sutta itself is really not that hard to understand, except that when our minds are rooted in fabrications, it's very difficult to see this at first. But it's just plain. It just says, from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, suffering occurs. Anybody can understand that. But it takes a while to really integrate it and understand the ramifications of this. Let me go to Jane. Jane, how are you? Are you there, Jane?
Oh, yeah. I'm fine. No, I always enjoy the sutta. Like I said, this is the one that didn't make sense to me in the beginning. And every time I hear it, I get more meaning from it. So, thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Yeah, I mean, I probably read this a dozen times before it really made any sense. And it really wasn't until I started developing the rest of the Buddha's Dhamma, particularly understanding what Four Noble Truths are, understanding what the Buddha meant by an Eightfold Path, understanding what he meant by the three marks of existence, because then you can see what he's getting at here. You know, and it makes perfect sense. And it helps define and contain our Dhamma practice, meaning it helps us stay focused on this one thing, ending ignorance, because that's the key problem, isn't it? Good.
Nice to see you, John. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. I don't think I have anything to add tonight. Really appreciate you giving this talk, and you're getting better at it. It's getting really clear.
So. Wow! That's good to know. Thank you. I was wondering when I get better at this. Good evening, Warner.
Good evening. Yeah, I've seen my own thoughts, the progression of my own thoughts, many times during your talk tonight, so yeah, I go along with you getting better at it, and I'm understanding it more, and it seems so simple, and yet it's so difficult, and you do wonder why you, when you look at your own thoughts and your own feelings, you know, to establish yourself, why does your mind just go there? Why doesn't it just accept what is happening because it's happening? You know, why do you have to personalize it? I don't know. It's difficult to...
That's the question you never ask.
I know, but it's it makes you think, the whole sutra makes you think and reflect and realize. Thank you.
Yeah, the why is just another speculative question that you ask yourself. Why does it matter? It's like the Buddha never felt like he needed to teach creationism at all. He never touched the subject, even though most of the teachings that he rejected from the Vedas and the Upanishads, that's really what they try to do, aren't they? Where do we come from? Who made us? Where are we going to go? The reason why you don't ask why is because this is what's occurring. There is no why. If I find myself confused or frustrated or I'm lacking understanding of something, the question isn't why. The question is what's going on right now that's causing this. Where am I? Where's my mind? Where's my thoughts? If they're out someplace else, that's why. Tim, what do you think of your first class?
Great. I'm kind of a noob to all this, but I identify with some of the stuff you were saying, like about the being irritable with things and taking things personally and stuff like that. So I think I've been guilty of all that. So
you're a human being.
Yeah, got a lot to learn. No, it's definitely interesting.
Yeah. Thank you. There is a lot to learn, but it really isn't. It takes time and perseverance, and you hear me say it all in great gentleness with yourself and the Dhamma practice. But everybody here has developed it. Yeah. And you should have seen these folks, especially Frank. Good to see you guys. Stay in touch. Okay, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good. This is my first time hearing this one, and it gave me a much better understanding of dependent origination. So I enjoyed
it. Thank you. Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't hear it first. But yeah, this is important. So I think other things will start fitting in a little better too for you. Hello, Helen. Wow, nice hair.
Busting on you that time.
Well, I realize I'm the last person to talk about people's hair.
I guess for me, it was my first retreat where I saw the Eightfold Path and dependent origination as a Mobius strip.
Oh, yeah, I remember you talking about that.
On one side is dependent origination. And then if you keep sticking with it, if you all know what a Mobius strip is, it sort of becomes like an infinity sign, sort of. But you get, if you're on one side, all you have to do is get on the other side where the Eightfold Path is. So at any time, you have the opportunity to wake up in that moment and get on the right path. So it's like once you hold the mirror up and see what mistakes you're making or misinformation you're working around, you can then just get on the Eightfold Path and you'll be just fine. You'll get to Oz.
Yes, you will. The Buddha taught an Eightfold Path to interrupt the progression of ignorance. Mm-hmm. And it does. I mean, that's the whole point. Thank you. Hello, Mary.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody. The first time I heard, and I say air quotes because I probably heard dependent origination many times before I heard it clearly, I was a wreck, so you're doing very well. I really, a mirror was held up and I saw many things about what I was doing or how I was living my life that, weren't necessarily harmful to anybody or anything, but weren't creating peace and happiness, although that's what I thought I was pursuing. They were actually creating significant suffering. So that was a real, you know, aha moment, as they say. But that awareness allows you to start interrupting. I love that word. Mm-hmm. Interrupting the patterns in your life,
yeah,
where you're continuing on in an ignorant fashion, where you're living the way you think you're supposed to be living. You're living the way you were raised, where you're living the way, you know, our culture is. You're behaving the way that your business culture behaves. And even if it's all good, you know, it's not anything you would call evil or awful or unethical. Mm-hmm. It's part of what's causing suffering, and it's certainly not bringing you to happiness. And then realizing that you can interrupt that, and that then it becomes your charge to interrupt that and catch yourself or be with people who can help catch you based on the words that are coming out of your mouth or the suffering that you're venting about. It all helps you get back on the path, as Helen was saying. So I think it's, my daughter had something when she was little, and the doctor said, it's going to take as long to get her out of this as it took to get into it.
Mm.
So I think that's likely true with this as well. Hopefully it's a little shorter to get out of all this, as long as it took me to get into all of this ignorance. But, you know, I'm very optimistic. I see evidence of it every day. I'm aware of the areas where I, for whatever reason, tend to continue clinging onto old concepts. And I think that with this one, probably true with everything, but with this one in particular, I think you really have to study it. You know, I think we can come here and we can listen to you, but however we learn things, like really learn things to make a difference in our lives and to allow us to interrupt the mental patterns, I think that there's an opportunity for me certainly to invest more time reading about it. Certainly David, you know, shares that point of view to really truly understand, because it does, you know, just all the fishboning that went on today in it, you know, the five clinging aggregates, the Eightfold Path, there's so much in there that I think each person has to really take the time to study it in their own way to truly, and then ask questions, of course. So anyway, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary. And the rest of our study is designed just that way,
mm-hmm.
you know, to touch on all these different subjects that were touched on here. But it is a good sutta to just read every now and then, even if you get a little confused, wondering what is this thing about ignorance? What is it? Well, it's ignorance with regard to stress, ignorance with regard to the cessation. You know, so it immediately focuses our Dhamma practice.
Well, and when we find ourselves back in a loop that is comfortable or familiar,
yeah,
or whatever, and we're wondering, you know, why did this person say this to me, or why did I do this, or whatever,
mm-hmm.
is to interrupt all of that and get back to the path, go back and read more about this, something.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Mary. Good evening, David.
Everyone comes to this or a spiritual practice for various reasons. This talk is what is really what you're here for.
Okay.
If you don't understand what the problem is and how the problem works, then applying the Eightfold Path without that knowledge will get you frustrated, or you won't keep with the practice. But if you understand this, then puts the solution into a better light and more practical use.
Yeah.
So without understanding what the second noble truth is, you're almost lost. So this is something to really understand and put into context of what really the solution is the Eightfold Path.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, and as we, I think 2 weeks from now, we'll be studying the an analysis of the Four Noble Truths by Sariputta. And the relationship is so easy to see in that analysis between Four Noble Truths, the analysis of the Four Noble Truths, and dependent origination. And it just defines Dhamma practice. Thank you. Hi, Bonnie.
John, nice to be here. It's really good to have you hear this. Mind is about, but it's here. Much more clear. And I'm going to take noble silence.
Thank you. Russ, how are you tonight?
I'm good, thank you. So one of the reasons I enjoy this practice is because it helps me to live a better life every day.
Yeah.
Deal with the things that, for example, I find it very typical not to take things personally, right? I mean, we're human beings, somebody says something, whether it's a work or personal life. But this gives me a way to deal with that. It's impermanent. I can go back to the meditation. I can think about it in a different way. Before, I didn't have that. So I would languish in that a lot longer, you know, when those things happen. And to me, that's just way of living a better life. So, I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's just what it's about, living a better life. Thank you. Julia, welcome to our Sangha. How was your first?
Thank you. I think it was good. The lesson that I received, the meaning from the lesson, is not to let ego penetrate our thoughts, our words, or our actions, so that we don't take things personal. And if we do that, less stress in living. I think that's what the meaning, what was that? Well, that's the meaning that I got.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's it, and on a very deep and profound level, not taking anything personally. I hope you continue to come to our classes. I don't know if you will. There's a sutta called the Dhatuvabhanga Sutta, where the Buddha teaches the what constitutes every human being. And what constitutes every human being is the four elements, earth, wind, fire, water, a fifth property known as space. You need the space to have something that those other properties can animate in, and the sixth property of consciousness. That's it. Every human being is defined that way, and when you look close enough, actually not too, it's just obvious, that's what constitutes human beings. Everything else is what we add on to it, what we describe ourselves to ourselves in the world. But if we realize that this is all I am and all I can ever be, we don't take anything personal because nothing is. I'm glad you came tonight.
Thank you.
Michael, welcome.
Well, thank you. This is what I kind of get out of this. And first of all, I enjoyed it very much, okay?
Great.
And we will be back.
Good, good, good.
The whole idea of everything being impersonal and accepting your reality, you know, whatever that reality might be, you know, whether it's good or bad, I think that we have no choice but to accept reality. It is what it is, and it always will be. The other thing that I liked, but I think is sometimes it's a difficult thing to practice or to know exactly what it is, and that is living in the present moment.
Ah.
Living in the present moment, to me, is being conscious every moment, word, action, thought, deed. I mean, being mindful with each and everything that filters through your mind and the action performed. So that's I think it took me a while to understand that concept of, you know, the now, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
But realizing that, you know, the past is gone, the future isn't here yet, we have no other moment than this moment now. And so if we can stick to that and be mindful in that moment, in every moment, and I think that's kind of falls within the parameters of your whole lecture tonight. And that's what I got out of this.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. The we get into words a little bit, but words like the present moment and the now can have their own bit of tension to them. You know, we can be too focused on, oh, am I in the now? Am I in the present moment? Rather than look at the Dhamma as being mindful of our life as our life occurs. And it is the same thing, but rather than becoming, am I in the present moment? Just be in this life.
I like that.
And that's really what the Buddha teaches. When ignorance is ended, there's nothing left, but there was nothing left but the present moment. But it's not an isolated thing. It's a little bit hard to describe, but we're simply in this continuum of our own life, and we're mindfully present of what's occurring. We're not here, there, just right here. And nothing is personal, and nothing is exceptional, except everything is. Everything is meaningful then, because we don't need it to be any different. In other words, I get a nice piece of chocolate cake, I can enjoy it because I don't need 4 more pieces of chocolate cake. Or I can meet somebody interesting and I'm not thinking about someone else because I'm present with this person. Or something awful happens. Some awful things just happened the last couple of days, didn't it? But I also understand that's part of having a human life. It's not good, it's not bad, it's just the way things are. Why take anything personal? Glad you're here. How did you find out about us?
I think weren't you guys located somewhere else?
We were just down the street.
Yeah, down the street. So we had, you know, obviously we live over, you know, we moved to Pennsylvania, like 3 years ago, and we had seen that you were at a location, and we thought, you know, we started, you know, of course we were in meditation.
Oh.
There, so we decided that, you know, that would be something that we'd be interested in doing, or, you know, just open our head in the door and see what it was all about. So we finally got around to doing it.
I'm glad you both did. Again, welcome to our sangha. Yeah, have you been to my website, becoming-buddha.com?
Yes, checked out the website, and we're familiar, and obviously we're going to become more familiar with it now. So.
Good. Yeah, there. On the top of there's a guided jhana meditation. If you click on that, you'll see that there's a 5 minute to 45 minute meditations like we just did here, guided meditations, if you want to listen to them. Thank you. Nick, good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you for sharing. I don't really have any real comments. I'm still just working on letting things go. Problem.
Yeah, it's a good thing to work on. I'm glad you're here tonight. There was an announcement. Our retreat is coming up. I think it's in 7 weeks, November 17th to the 20th. If you're going, and you know you're going, please sign up as soon as you can because it helps my logistics greatly. If you're not going, don't bother signing up. But you should go. I mean, there's no substitute for 4 days immersed in the Dhamma. And my retreats aren't like other, it's not a silent retreat. There's no value in forced silence. It's immersion in the Dhamma.
You said November, it's October?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. October 17th and October 20th. Info's on the website. All right, let's finish with metta as we always do. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.